one of the last things that we'll look at, and I don't see where my factors are. But there is, for instance, the BE Act and the Credit National Credit Act says that you should look at, for instance, how big what the value of the agreement is, whether the person cooperated, whether what was the market behavior in general. So in other words, if it was clearly maybe a new person at APSA now, and apologies now again for using APSA, but just to continue the example, if it was a new employee at APSA, the person didn't understand the processes and made a clear clerical kind of error, then they will probably, the administrative fine will be negligible or maybe not even a fine, just to say, please don't do it again. So, but a fine can, fine normally follows an offense unless it's an administrative fine. So we can go that route as well.
Honourable Montage, but before you, I just want to hear from the members. Honourable Montage, what do you think about this so far?
I still am where I was until I'm convinced, Chair, whether we cannot use that one. I've not heard clearly what the Advocate Mafando Mareve is saying on my proposal. Is it wrong to use that, or which the PPPE is saying as an offence or as a consequence of not complying with the Act?
It's not the Advocate Mafando Mareve. It's me that's asking the question whether or not. You see, my concern is if we say it's an offence and then somebody you know, is now guilty of that offence or has not reported this reckless lending, then we're going to involve the South African police services. Now, I'm not sure whether or not that is necessarily what we should do. Is there no mechanism in place that if you fail to report reckless credit to the national credit regulator, you will be, the first time you will be told here to pay 5,000 rand, the second time it will be 55,000 rand, and the third time you lose your licence? You know, without involving the police. Is there any way, I'm not saying that it is, or is the best way to involve the police? This is what I'm trying to establish. How do we de-incentivize people to, you know, to actually report these reckless lendings to the National Credit, you know, how do we do that? Which is the easiest way and doesn't involve time and money spent by the state, because somebody recklessly lent somebody else 5,000 rand, the state's going to spend 100,000 rand on this, you know, with the police, you know.
Jay, maybe just to quickly answer the question of Ms. Montage, the BEE is in fact one of the acts that I looked at, and the fines that you are referring to are in fact administrative fines under the BEE. So they're not running via a court. I'm putting up on the screen section 151 of the Act, which deals with administrative fines. And it says that the tribunal may impose an administrative fine in respect of prohibited or required conduct. And then this may not exceed 10% or 1 million. And then when determining, the tribunal must consider the following factors: nature, duration, gravity, extent of the contravention, loss or damage, the behavior of the respondent. The respondent would be the credit provider or a debt counselor. So this maybe comes back to what the tribunal said before. Sorry, I'm just referring to the to just keep it as prohibited conduct, and then it is covered under this. So, yes, it is currently there, and we're not seeing a lot of that happening in practice, but that then maybe becomes an oversight concern rather than something for the legislation. So we can maybe link it to this section 151 and just make sure that 151 will apply to that that behavior.
If that's, I agree if that's what he means, that it will apply as it is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair. I was going to suggest that perhaps the committee would want to look at how to police this non-reporting, because I think that's where perhaps the crux is, that currently the debt counsellors are the only ones that can determine that and take it to court if they say that this is reckless lending. But if they themselves fail to report, at what point can it be picked up? perhaps maybe then develop more teeth for the NCR to be able to, I don't know, on a sampling basis sometimes or just on an investigation, do the actual assessment of whether a credit or give it to somebody to be able to do that determination. Because it means now you are now second guessing what the debt counselor has determined and then being able then to say they didn't comply or they did comply. Or the other thing, Chair, I was going to suggest that perhaps we look at also in determining the administrative penalty for that, perhaps look at a percentage of the reckless credit itself as some kind of a fine instead of the entire revenue of the of the entity.
Thank you. Okay, so what we've agreed with Honourable Mantashe and the full quorum of this important meeting is that we'll link it to that section. So we're gonna. So how would it read then? That number three, advocate. How would it read? It would say a credit provider or debt counselor who fails to report a suspected reckless credit agreement to the national credit regulator. Over to you.
Yeah, I actually think that whole section will come out because we have simply said that you must do something. So failure, I will just need to make sure that 151 actually will cover this, that it is automatically covered. It might be an amendment to a section. I'm not sure if there's a section that specifically deals with prohibited conduct. I know there are sections that deals with certain groupings of things. Just want to make sure maybe there will be a consequential amendment to that rather than having something here. If there isn't, perhaps I will just say failure to do so will constitute prohibited conduct and may be subject to an administrative fine if we want to make it very clear.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's how it's going to read, what you've just said. So that's, we can move on to the next point then. And if, okay, so that's what we're going to do. Are you happy, Honourable Mantashe? Okay. We can move on to clause 13.
This one we have discussed last time that we've met, so I'm not going to go into too much detail. The question we've got currently, the criteria is child-headed household and a person who falls within the no income, no assets category. But the question then came up, what if the person who is heading the household, the minor, actually has an inheritance of a couple of, you know, million rands? Because we don't require this child to, this minor, to actually be, to have a problem in this in relation to debt and so on. Then the proposal was made, but should we not just delete the reference to child-headed household, simply make it earn below 7,500? Because if it is a minor who earns below 7,500, that minor will be included. If the minor is above 7,500, the minor will qualify for debt review, et cetera, et cetera. So the question simply is, do we delete child-headed household? The question started coming up because Justice made the comments about, but what about female-headed households? What about disability, people with disabilities? So it started having this list, and the list suddenly started opening up all these problems because not all female-headed households should qualify for this debt relief. They're not in debts. Problems. The fact that, or rather, if I can put it differently, the fact that a person, for instance, is disabled doesn't mean that the person is currently in need of debt relief. That's almost discriminatory with all due respect to say that, you know, automatically that will be the case. So when we looked at child-headed household, that came from the municipalities with their indigent requirements, and some of them have this as part of indigent. And I mean, it affects a very small portion. It just affects your water and sanitation and things like that. And you can almost think that even if the child has some money to be able to pay debts, this is perhaps something that the state should be doing for a minor running a household, to give them free services. So perhaps a child-headed household is not something that is appropriate then for our bill. But then that is the question. Do we take it out or do we keep it?
I'm just going to give my opinion on this. I did suggest that we just write there, earn below 7,500 rand, and then that should cover everybody. But I also think that we should mention child-headed households and disabled-headed households, because we want to put emphasis onto these sectors of a society. We don't want child-headed households to slip through the gaps, because fundamentally, the child-headed household might not, for instance, a social worker might not think to add a child-headed household. You know, who's going to do the application? This 12-year-old child is going to go and do the application for debt relief, and that might not be the case. But if we actually specify child-headed households, then we can put some emphasis onto social workers that deal with them and remind them that their child-headed households actually do qualify for this. So I don't know how can I suggest earn below 7,500 rand per month, to include but not limited to child-headed households, disabled, and then just put a small list in there so that those people can be highlighted as, you know, beneficiaries of this act. Honourable Montash.
I normally don't differ with you, Chairperson, but my question would rise to say, at which point does a child in care debt, let's say my 8-year-old, I die now, and he has not incurred any debt, why do we involve them in this bill? And when I last checked, I thought this was a once-off thing that we are applying for. Then where does children get into? Where do they feature? My children don't have debt. I do. So can I be clarified? In that space, I don't agree with the change. I think we must remove the child-headed households part of this bill.
The National Credit Regulator will answer that question.
Chairperson, if there's credit life, if you have credit, if you took credit life with your loan, then, you know, in the event that something happens to you, you happen to pass on, then, you know, insurance will pay out. But if you didn't, then the child-headed household is left with that debt to pay off.
Thanks, Chair. I wanted to make an example for Honorable Mandash. For example, a bond. If you, like the CEO is saying, you don't have a credit life on the bond, even if you have, but it doesn't pay enough to cover the rest of the amount. There are also things that you might have bought on credit, like the necessary stuff in the house. Now, if you don't have a cover for all of that, for your kids, for example, they need to use the stove and everything to go to school and all of that, if that is going to be attached because it hasn't been paid as a result of a debt that is still outstanding. So we're trying to sort of cushion them from that particular environment. Because there are many households where parents have taken debt without any credit life cover, to the extent that the credit providers will follow, you know, whoever was staying in there, you know. So it was for including that, it was only to cover the children who have to remain in that particular household.
Chairperson, maybe this is where an awareness campaign needs to kick in to educate the middle class to ensure that they have credit life on their debt. But it can't be the burden of the state, the recklessness of parents, of the middle class. The poor of the poorest do not have such debt. They don't. They only have debt that they incur through the reckless lending by loan sharks and stuff. And I don't agree. The poor of the poorest that we're dealing with, we're trying to protect in by enacting this bill, do not have such debt. For instance, my mom, who just died, had no debt. He was living on her pension. He depended on me. There are so many mothers like her and him and fathers out there. They don't have debt, comrades. So we cannot encourage the middle class not to take credit life. We must educate them to take it. We can't put that burden on the state. And that's my point of view. Thank you.
Okay, with regard to that, my point of view is that we can't allow for some child-headed households to slip through the gap while everybody else is getting the debt relief measure, and then they don't get it because they weren't mentioned. I'm not saying that all child-headed households are in this position. I'm just saying that there may be some. And so that if we highlight child-headed households, it just gives them the opportunity to apply. It's just a highlight thing. It's not about... It's if they earn a collective under the 7,500 rand per month, then they qualify. But just to mention child-headed households, households headed by disabled people, those sort of things, these are the most vulnerable of the vulnerable. But if... Okay, just
to add, this is very, Honorable Mantashe, this is very prevalent in the mining communities. You will find that people have taken 4 or 5 loans from the loan sharks. Unfortunately, the loan sharks will be gunning for anything that they can get out of that. That's the group that I think was at the back of the policy imperative to say those who will be victims of loans that have been taken. I mean, in the mining space, you'll find that people have got more than 10 loans. Correctly, as you have correctly put it, that they might have been reckless. But unfortunately, now the kids have to remain with that particular debt, unfortunately. So it's very prevalent in that space.
If I may come in here, first off, I think that simply to mention, in other words, we make the criteria no income, no asset, and we simply indicate somewhere that this would include someone who, you know, a child-headed household, someone with disability, women-headed households, whatever the list was that was given there. So that just highlights that it doesn't make them necessarily qualify. We can definitely do that. Then as we were talking, I started thinking about something, and perhaps it's not something that should delay the bill, but there still has to be, consultations on the bill and so on. And perhaps something that the committee can consider is to actually ask someone from the social services department to come and talk to us about child-headed households. Because what I'm just thinking is the debt that they would be sitting with, I was more thinking in line of incidental credit. In other words, it's not something where they entered into an agreement. It was they purchased groceries from the store on the corner, and there is an account, so you pay at the end of every month, and this month they now fell short. And because they fell short, suddenly interest is raised, and then it becomes incidental credit. So that is then when they will be covered under this. But if we are talking about debts of the parents that come to the children, I actually think that there's a social service element here, because it is not the child's debt, it is the estate's debt. And I'm almost not even thinking that the children will be able to ask for debt relief, because it is not their debt to ask relief for. So it is maybe something that we need to maybe just consult further, but if we simply mention it to say below 7,500, this will include, so I can make it one of the points to say it will include this list. So that we put some emphasis there. If, you know, we make it clear, these people will be covered. But they maybe consult with social services and just get peace of mind in our own heads what is happening with these children. Because, like I say, I really did not think that they will be saddled with the deaths of their parents. That falls in the estate. So probably what happens is that in order for furniture not to be attached, the child might do work at the same grocery store where they are purchasing or something. That money goes into paying for the furniture so that the beds remain, etc., and not be attached. But they're paying off someone else's debt. They're paying off their parents' debt. And I think that is not necessarily because of a legal obligation. It is more because of a practical situation. So I'm paying on behalf of my parents so that the furniture is not attached. But it's not their debt. It's their parents' debt or the estate's debt if the parent is dead. So, yeah, my proposal would be the compromise. Let's highlight these vulnerable sections as part of the 7,500 category. And then maybe we just consult a bit more and just get more information on this and make sure that we cover what we intend to cover.
No, I am not opposed to what the advocate is saying, but I want to explain why I am where I am. I don't want this bill to be rejected because of the cumbersome amounts of funds that will be needed to ensure that it is activated. So I thought we would streamline it so that when we table it in Parliament, we are not seen as the people who are not reasonable enough looking at the economic situation of our country, comrades. I don't want us to overload or to put a lot of responsibility on the government. That's why I was talking about awareness campaigns. For that matter, comrades, even those unlearned people out there, the poor, when they take those debt, maybe whether it's furniture and stuff, there is a hidden amount that they pay for insurance that they are not told to use when the tough times come. So that's why I'm saying let awareness campaigns kick in to save the people of South Africa. And we cover through this debt the really needy ones. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, so we have some consensus. So what we'll do is we'll have the list, we'll have the 7,500 and then the lists of the people. You must understand that the 7,500 is the real criteria. We're just highlighting, for instance, you know, so it's because that's not going to change. If you take child-headed households off the list, it's not going to change the 7,500 rand criteria. The amount, the gross amount that of debt relief won't change with the list of names of sectors. It's the 7,500 that makes that difference. So if you make it 6,500, that would make a big difference, but we're not dropping that again from 10. So that's what we'll do for that section. Can we move to the next section then?
Thank you, Chair. The next one now deals with the income, the 7,500 that we've just been talking about. Mrs. Phipps asked the question whether the salary, the income, that must not exceed 7,500 per month is net or gross salary. My first instinct was that this should be the net salary, so I've excluded tax deductions. But then I thought, should it be net? Should it be gross? I might be asking a question or assuming an answer, rather, that is incorrect. And if it is the net salary, should we also say that it is after UIF and pension deductions? So what does this 7,500 consist of?
Now, this is a biggie, because my concern with this is how do we measure net? So in other words then, do we then say your total salary is so-and-so minus your tax, minus your UIF, minus your pension, and then we use that number? So because some people might say, well, I'm minusing my house from that as well, and so I mean, my net is about 7,500, you know, so do I qualify for debt relief? You know, so what do you think, Honorable Montash? What are we going to do here? Because if we say it's the net, like, for instance, you and I'm sure your net's about 7,500, the same as mine, you know, so we can't qualify for debt relief.
Chairperson, we should measure it against the gross, because the net is determined by how much you spend your salary. So we can't base it on that. Some other, like myself, I don't even have 7.5 after my deduction. So, but I earn, you see. So I suggest that we use the gross.
I'm of the opinion, yeah, I agree. I think it should be the gross salary. So we'll leave it as the gross. Can we move to the next section, please?
The next one, then, is to look at the next criteria in this category of consumers. So even if the gross salary is 7,500, it still has to be someone who is over-indebted. So do we look at the prescribed affordability assessment, which is a calculation and things can go easily wrong, or do we do 25% of the income? And Margot pointed out to me that it should be that the installments on his or her total unsecured debt is 25% or more of that income. So in other words, on your monthly installments, if that is 25% or more of your income for that month, then you're over-indebted, then you're regarded to be over-indebted. The question came up, where does this 25% come from? What I got from GTI is that the 75% is the 75-25% relates to what a person needs to live. I think that we had some debt counselors that indicated that, in fact, in this income category, the 7,500 and less, a consumer actually needs 80% of their income to be able to live. So, in fact, it should perhaps be 20% of their income. Installments equaling 20% or more of their monthly salary will make them over-indebted. So that is there. So the question here is, what should the percentage per month be that the consumer need for living expenses? Because anything that cuts into that percentage will make them over-indebted. And then that is the percentage that we'll use.
It should be 20 then, Chairperson. 20%.
Okay, I'm also of the opinion that it should be 20%. Now, this 80%, they need 80% to live. So if they're paying back 20% or more. Now, this, where did we get this? Just from, say to me where you got the 20% from. I mean, can it be 15%? I mean, you know, it's only 7,500 rands. You know, it's not like people who earn 7,500 rand get to pay less for stuff, you know. They pay exactly what we pay. So I think why are we even thinking about their over-indebtedness? Surely at that level, any debt is basically over-indebted. You know what I'm saying? Are we not going to say anybody who earns below 7,500 rand qualifies? But now how much... We should have a number. How much debt relief should we give them? Do you understand what I'm saying here, Honourable Montoya? So we need to come up with a number. So we could say, for instance, this debt relief measure will give debt relief to people earning below 7,500 rand a month gross to the amount of 2,000 rand, something like that. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. No.
Before the applicant, in the public service, an employee cannot go beyond 15% on deductions in the public service. So maybe we should go the same route. Because if we don't, people would be left with nothing to survive. 15%.
Okay, so we've got the 15% instead of the 20%. But I'm saying that that percentage is sort of zero. If you're in debt and you earn 7,500 rand gross, you qualify to have, and we should come up with a number now, I think, because this hasn't come before into this committee. I'm not sure how we're going to do it, because you could be you could be 6,000 rand in debt and only earning 7,500 and just borrowing from your one place to pay off the other place, that sort of spiral into chaos. So if you can just give us some idea here. Yeah, thank you, Advocate.
Okay. Chip, our limit on debt is 50,000. So the debt relief that the person will be entitled to is 50,000. that's the debt relief that they'll get, because that's the amount of the debt that we set to qualify. So it can't be more than 50,000. So if they earn 7,500, the total amount that will be either suspended first and then extinguished is 50,000. So that's the big amount. The whether there should be a percentage is a policy decision. I think from the regulator, they quickly whispered in my ear to say, if you don't have this requirement, if it's simply income, it makes it easier to evaluate, because then you don't. If you only have the requirement of what is your income, they can say, oh, 7,500, you qualify. But otherwise, they will also have to look at what the person say they are actually paying. Because if they are paying less than the 20 or the 15%, then they don't qualify. So they might lie about that. So you need to then get the information about what are they actually paying per month. So there's more to evaluate. So yes, it would make it easier for the regulator to do that evaluation. The reason we put something in is to make sure that we either assume, or I don't know if there's the necessary stats for that, that everyone who earns 7,500 or less are over indebted. And if that is what we are saying, then you don't need to say that someone is over indebted. If we say, but perhaps some of them aren't over indebted, then that is when you bring in the percentage calculation. So if the view is that, no, we accept that everyone earning 7,500 rand at this point in time is over indebted, but they will only qualify up to the 50,000 that we've set the debt are, then we just keep the 7,500 and we take this percentage out. Then we don't do an over indebted calculation at all. But like I said, that is just a policy decision.
Honourable Montash, did you get that? So we're taking the percentage down to zero, not 15 or 20 or whatever. So it's even better for the poorest. My question to everybody is, can South Africa afford to take everybody who earns less than 7,500 rand a month and basically give them 50,000 rand to pay their debt off? So that's the real question here. Because, you know, can somebody, you know, from all of these agencies, please tell us how likely this is to happen?
My hand was not up, Chair, but, I remember being viciously attacked the first time I spoke about considering the business person as well, because I think they do tend to also seek justice, as the DG of TTI correctly said the other day, that as we look at relieving the debt, we actually also touching on somebody else's balance sheet. And so I think, yeah, it's a question truly worth considering, but I do not necessarily have any suggestions at the moment. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, remember not all of that debt will be written off. Some will be suspended, some credit agreements will be suspended, you know, and then others will be restructured. And it's really, it will depend on the determination by the tribunal at the time when they receive the recommendations from the NCR.
I do understand that, but we should look at worst possible scenario for the business sector. I'm not saying that I'm pro-business. I'm just saying that we don't want to put a law in place that fundamentally, I don't know how many people earn 7,500 rand or less. It could be a million people. We're going to give a million people 50,000 rand. Actually, the banks and the financial service providers are going to give a million people 50,000 rand debt relief. You know what I'm saying? It's going to be very good for the, you know, those people will then have disposable income and et cetera. But I'm just saying the reality of it, that's what we're putting into legislation now. Even though some of it will be suspended and some of it will be this and that, but the worst case scenario or the best case scenario is that, say, 2 million people get 50,000 rand debt relief paid for by the private sector. I mean, that's quite a lot of money. But I think we should go that way. I think we should take that down to zero and say 7.5 and then keep it at the 50,000 and see what the, when we go for public hearings, what the response is. So that's what we'll do. Are we agreed, Honourable Montash? Okay, can we go to the next clause there?
The next one deals with the criteria for the application. It deals with realizable assets. And the question that we have here, I don't think this is a difficult one. We are also looking at assets that the person has. So in respect of, I just want to get the 1, 2, and 3, yeah. So we say that the person must not have, which in order to qualify, must not have realizable assets. But we looked at the Magistrates Court Act here. Now, paragraphs 1, 2, and 3 there, which deals with necessary tools and implements of trade, stock and agricultural implements, professional books, documents or instruments used by that applicant in his or her profession, and necessary household furniture and household utensils, are all limited to 2,000 Rand. So each, and of the tools are limited to 2,000 Rand. Professional books, limited to 2,000 Rand. Household furniture and household utensils, limited to 2,000 Rand. The only thing that's not limited is the beds, bedding, and wearing apparel. And I'm almost not even sure if wearing apparel should not also be limited to 2,000 Rand. But it isn't in the Magistrates Courts, Magistrates Court Act, so perhaps not. So the question that we need to answer just, the first question is, do we limit this to 2,000 Rand in value? And then the last paragraph, the 6, that deals with arms and ammunition, as the applicant would be required by law, regulation, or a disciplinary order to have in his or her possession. The previous time I spoke to this, I said I asked Justice what this means. But they indicated to me that this refers to the police service, and but the guns are owned by the police service. The policeman is just allowed to have it. So I'm not sure even why it is in there, because if it's not their property, it can't be attached. And I'm also saying that if it is maybe their own weapon, like a security guard, for instance, then surely that will fall under necessary tools and implements of trade, because you need that for your profession. So the second question then is, should we retain arms and ammunition? Should it be limited?
Okay. So the first question was, just repeat the first question on that clause so we can discuss.
So the first question is whether the tools and implements of trade should be limited to 2,000, professional books limited to 2,000, necessary household furniture and household utensils limited to 2,000, perhaps wearing apparel limited to 2,000.
So what is the question? Is the question, should we limit it to 2,000 or should we leave it open?
Yes, the question is, should we limit it? So in other words, a person would qualify as long as they don't have any necessary tools and implements, etc., that are more than 2,000 Rand, professional books that are more than 2,000 Rand, household furniture more than 2,000 Rand. The argument is those could be sold to defray your debts. They are more than what is necessary for you to live and work.
I'm getting scared, Chair. Advocate Van der Merwe, I have a picture of a household where, as this committee, we allow that their beds be taken away, that their clothing must be taken away. I am not sure if we will be doing the right thing. Oh, if it is possible, can we remove that from this bill?
The bill says that the people can keep their stuff to the value of 2,000.
Oh,
now,
okay.
Should we have that 2,000 because a fridge costs 2,000? So must we lift it up? That's what the bill is saying. Is those people won't get all their stuff taken away as long as it's under the value of 2,000?
Okay. Well, I think we must have the cap, Ketchy. The cap of 2,000 is fine.
I thought you were saying this must be taken away.
No, we're trying to help the poor.
The next question then is, should we retain the arms and ammunition paragraph 6, that's up now? It is in the Magistrates Court Act. Should we limit it to 2,000? Should we take it away?
On the arms and ammunition, if it's a security guard who has to have a gun, then it should fall under his tools of the trade. And we have mentioned tools of the trade to the value of 2,000. Mike, we've said 2,000, I think we should take away specifically the clause that talks about arms and ammunition, because now we're specifying tools of trade. So I think we shouldn't do that. I think that we should just say tools of trade, because another clause could be, you know, a drill and a, you know. So I think we should remove arms and ammunition completely. What do you think? And it falls under tools of trade if you need that a gun as a tool of trade.
We are fighting for a gun-free society. I don't think there's anyone amongst ourselves who keeps such an ammunition, Jefferson.
Okay. So we agree then. We agree to remove that clause from that section. Okay, moving along to the next one. Because, of course, when we go back to committee, this could all get changed again. But as we sit in the subcommittee, this is where we are. Okay.
The next one is something that has been, people were very, very unsure about this either way. And that is whether developmental credit should be excluded. In other words, should things like NSFAS loans be written off in terms of the state intervention? Currently, we have excluded it. So in other words, it will form part of the 50,000 that you apply. In other words, when you apply, your debt may not be more than 50,000. Your NSFAS loan will be included in that calculation for 50,000, but when you get to the tribunal, the NSFAS loan will not be extinguished.
In my opinion, I don't think that we should include NSFAS loans in the debt relief, because if we write this debt off, then we might take away from somebody else learning. Because it's a loan for you to study, and therefore when you pay it back, then you pay it back so somebody else can study. But if you write it off, then that money is basically gone, and there's a space there where there used to be a student, now there's a hole. So I don't think that we should include NSFAS into this. Honorable Mantash?
I agree with you,
sir.
I agree with you. We must not get into that space of NSFAS.
So on that point, NSFAS comes out, but now developmental credit, what is that also the same section? What does that mean exactly, other than NSFAS? What else could developmental credit be?
I'm going to put the bill after the act up. Okay, and the regulator says she wants to talk to that.
Developmental credit refers...
Sorry, did you get permission from
the chairperson? Okay. I'm sorry, you can carry on now.
I'm sorry, Honorable Chairperson. Developmental credit refers to small businesses, loans towards small businesses, towards low-cost housing, towards education, and small cooperatives.
I'd just like to know, what are the implications, for instance, now, obviously cooperative loans to businesses won't be qualified, will fall outside of this debt relief measure. So other than NSFAS, what other developmental that falls inside of this exists? That's what I want to know. National Credit Regulator, tell us that. So we don't want to know about small business loans. You're not going to get debt relief on your small business loan, and you're not going to get debt relief on your small cooperative loan. So what other developmental, other than education, is available to these people that they may want to write off?
Perhaps a loan towards low-cost housing, because these are the listed categories in the National Credit Act that constitutes developmental credit. Yes. Yes, Chairperson.
Honorable Montage, what do you think? Do you think we must include low-cost housing loans? No, don't worry about the piece of paper you've been given. It's not related to this question. The question is about, do we include developmental loans? And so, for example, the example has been given is NSFAS, which we've said is we shouldn't include, and now it said low-cost housing. I think we should take it all out. I think... DTI?
Thanks, Chair. I think the policy position around that space is too is to say that we don't want to resolve other problems by creating other problems. For example, if we get into the space, you'll find that there will be a lack of appetite to fund that space. So that's what we don't want to experience. Hence the exclusion or the exception. So it's one thing that I wanted to emphasize. So we rather leave it out. Yeah.
Okay, so that's the decision of sub. We're leaving out all of those things, excluding them. Are you still with us, Honorable Advocate? We can move to the next section.
The next question. Now, when we do when we move to the actual where the tribunal is considering the application, the tribunal will, before we get to the debt relief, could make a couple of other type of orders, one of which will be the debt relief. So, for instance, if the tribunal is of the view that the person doesn't qualify, can refer to a debt counselor, etc., etc. One of them is, if the tribunal is of the view that the applicant can pay, but it would not be effective to refer the person to a debt counselor, the tribunal can then determine maximum interest, maximum fees, other charges for a period not exceeding 12 months. Mr. McPherson suggested 6 months. And the committee initially said, when we discussed the 6 months versus 12 months, the committee at that stage felt that 6 months is too short in which to cap this interest and allow the person to pay back. If you think about the debt counseling, there you have over 5 years period where this is capped. And the person will then have to come back after the 6 months. But if it is 12 months, at least it is a year period where the person has time to recover a bit with this. So the question is, should we shorten to the 6 months as Mr. McPherson suggested, or do we retain it at 12 months for this capping of interest and other charges?
If I can just come in here. So in other words then, it's all about if we remain at 12 months, it gives the person more time because the process might not complete within the 6. Is that what you're saying? So you might have to do it again if it would be more cumbersome if it was 6 months. It could become more cumbersome. So I propose that we keep it at 12 months. Honorable Montash?
No, I think 12 months is fine. I think my person was talking for the rich people, not the poor.
The other question then is, when we now get to the next step, so the tribunal has decided that this is a debt relief candidate and has done the first 12 months suspension. Might even the person has come back in that 12 months and the tribunal said, look, it looks like you're getting up on your feet again. We're going to suspend for another 12 months. In the end, the person comes before the tribunal. Tribunal says, no, this is not going to help to further suspend. We need to extinguish. And then the question is, should that extinguishing be in respect of 100% of the debt always? In other words, we don't say that it may be in respect of a percentage, or should we say that the tribunal can say, if I look at your circumstances, you can actually repay 50% of your debts. So we are going to extinguish 50% of your debt, and it will then apply to every agreement equally. So the only thing that might be different is that it might be 50%, 25%, 70% that's extinguished, and the person then repays the rest. So that's the first possibility. Or the second possibility, we simply say the tribunal must extinguish 100%.
Do you want to talk on this?
Yes.
Okay, Honorable Mantar.
Credit providers must be able to sustain their business. We cannot say 100% of the debt must be extinguished. I would go for 50% if that's the... I would go for 50% to percent, because credit providers must also live or sustain their businesses. We would be killing the economy if we say we extinguish the whole debt. We'll be irresponsible MPs.
Yep. Okay. I disagree with you there. Could the tribunal just come in on this point, please? Honourable Montage, can you just switch off your microphone, please?
Thanks, Chair. I think, Chair, perhaps it's best to leave such to case-by-case basis, to cater for circumstances for each case, so that the investigators will be able to come and motivate. And then based on that, then on a balance of justice, then the tribunal should be able to make that decision.
Okay. Do you get that, Honourable Montage? We're going to let the tribunal decide. It could go down to 0%, you know, depending on case-by-case basis.
I have no problem with anything that isn't.
Yep. So that's what we'll do. We'll let it, the tribunal decide, because, you know, who are we to make that decision? Okay. The next section.
The next one deals with the mandatory training versus non-mandatory. What we've done is we've made it one of the possible conditions that the tribunal may set to say that you must attend a financial literacy or budgeting skills program. The question came up, there is no such program at the moment. Who is going to pay for it? So what we've done already is we are requiring the minister to prescribe, and he must, it's not a may, must prescribe such a program. Whether that program will be in place for these orders, I don't know. So currently, it is simply a possibility. And if we think about it, some of these orders may run into 24 months because of suspension and maybe a further suspension. So perhaps at your second round of the suspension, your 12 months have passed. Maybe at that point, there is such a program in place, and then the tribunal can make that order. But at this point in time, if we make it mandatory, it means that the department will have to make sure that there is something like that available, because otherwise the tribunal's order will the person will not be able to comply with the order of the tribunal, and therefore will be in contempt of the tribunal's order, but it will be an impossibility. So the question is, should we make it mandatory or retain it as it is now, so that there's an obligation on the minister? And then for now, it is simply a discretion that is given to the tribunal once such a program is in place to then make that order.
Honourable Montage, what do you think?
I am unable to talk on a program that is non-existent, Chair. I'm unable because I don't know whether there would be budget for the minister to enforce that which we say he must do. I can't speak. I have no way.
Okay. So, but before we get there, this training is very important because we not only want to relieve debt, we also want to change the way people relate to money, and in particular how they relate to credit. So it's so important as training, but the whole thing is, again, you know, we might not have the resources to train those 2 million applicants. So I suggest we leave it as it is, and then it becomes an option further down. But it's important that we don't neglect this training for people who have got over indebted, so that they don't come back again and be over indebted. More over indebted, because they're going to get their debt relief, you know, and then they're going to try and get credit from elsewhere. So I think the training is important, but we must definitely look at how difficult it's going to be to implement that. So I suggest we leave it as it is.
Next one is on the prohibition to enter into a debt agreement for a certain period. So first off, the question is, currently it is still an option It is not something that the tribunal must impose, but the tribunal may place a limitation on the applicant's right to apply for credit, and it may not exceed. And then we give some period. So in other words, if it is just a suspension and then the person was able to pay, it will become 12 months. If it was maybe a double suspension, it will become 24 months. And if it was extinguishing, it becomes 36 months that the person is not allowed to apply for debt. So the question then is, should it be, first of all, something that is discretionary, or is it something that must be given? So that's the first question. If either way, what should the period be? Should it be up to? Should it be a fixed period? And then there is another option that is done in New Zealand. The limitation on applying for credit is not a full limitation. They are allowed to borrow for, let's say, up installments up to 5% of their income. But anything that exceeds 5% of their income, that is limited then for a period of 5 years or how many ever years. So those are the options. But this is then something that we need to look at. Should it be mandatory? Should it be a discretion? In other words, case by case. So the tribunal looks at it, see that the reason, if I can just maybe make this example, the reason why it is drafted as a discretion is for the instance where a person, for instance, was retrenched, had less than 7,500 income, huge problem, qualified because of the 50,000 debt, and in fact, this person only had 50,000 debt because they were a very responsible debtor, consumer, and now the person qualified, it was suspended for 12 months. The person comes back within that 12 months and says, ah, I've got a very nice job. I'm earning my 60,000, 70,000 rand a month again, and I can now pay all my debtors. Thank you very much. Now, should it then be mandatory for that person to still have 12 months not applying? It could be that we say, look, you did make use of this debt relief. You did impact on your credit provider, and the impact of that or the results of that is that for 12 months you cannot enter into a credit agreement, period, regardless of you are now of the fact that you are now able and look like you could be a responsible consumer again. So I suppose the question boils down to, is there something that almost is seen as a penalty for applying? Or is it something to see that the person is rehabilitated, or both? Because if it is a penalty, it should be mandatory. If it is, well, if it's a penalty and I suppose the rehabilitation will definitely always be part of it. But if it is also a penalty, then it must be mandatory. If we say it is only about rehabilitation, then it should be a discretion. And then we can just look at the period.
Honourable Mantosh, do you have anything to say on this? Because I think it's very complicated. This must go to the committee.
It's complicated because we also don't want to bar people from participating in the economy. So it should rather go to the committee first, that one.
Okay, this one will go into the committee. It's quite a big one. Okay, the next section.
The next question now is, if a person was granted this debt intervention, and maybe it ties into the above question, in fact, because if a person is now limited from applying, what this subsection does is to say that regardless of this, you can still enter into a developmental agreement, in other words, your low-cost housing, your NESFAS, or a public interest credit agreement. The public interest, just to jog people's memories, is where there was a flood, for instance, and everyone lost their houses, and the minister then puts in place a public interest measure where people can enter into loans to just get their houses back up. So probably your public interest credit is something that would remain given the nature of it. But the question is, should the person who has just received this debt intervention be allowed to enter into a developmental credit agreement?
For me on this thing, I say that they should be allowed to enter into a developmental, because developmental credit is not covered by this. So it's not like they've just written off one NESFAS and now they're applying for another one. So it's not related as a form of credit. So I think that they should be able to go for both this, these two, the two types of credit that you talked about. Honorable Montash?
I don't think anyone must be barred from developmental agendas.
Next section.
The next one deals with the rehabilitation. So we've made provision for, so a person was now, the person's right to enter into credit agreement was suspended for 12 months or 24 months. In that period, the person now gets a nice job, can actually pay back all the creditors, and then that person can apply for rehabilitation. So the person comes and applies for rehabilitation. The question is, should rehabilitation only be in cases where the debt was actually extinguished in the end, or should it be for any of the orders that was allowed under this section, so under this part? So in other words, should it be where in any situation where this person's right to apply for credit was suspended, should it apply to all of those, regardless if it was in respect of suspension, extinguishing, capping interest, etc.? Should the person be allowed to apply for rehabilitation in all of those circumstances?
With this, I just want some clarity, but I think that if you've got 20,000 rand debt and you've got it written off or suspended or whatever through the debt relief process, and then you win the lotto, and then you pay the 20,000 rand back, you should be able to just recut, you know, you should start from zero again, from scratch. So I think it should be in all cases. What argument said, did anybody argue that it shouldn't be in all cases? That's what I want to know.
When we discussed rehabilitation, we only spoke about extinguishing. So this is more me just confirming that I'm not exceeding my mandate if I make it in respect of everything, because it makes sense to me to be in everything, but we only spoke about extinguishing.
Okay, so Honorable Natasha, do you agree? Yep. So I think that we should talk, if you've applied for debt relief through this mechanism, and then you get whatever debt relief you get, regardless of what type it was, and then you can come back with a full repayment, you're off the hook, you're done. Now the question, there's another question now. What about interest? Oh, is it coming? Okay.
The next question is exactly that, because in sequestration proceedings, rehabilitation is possible if you pay in full plus interest calculated from the date of sequestration. Now, the question then is, should the debt intervention applicant only have to pay back what was owed on the date of the application? Because remember, everything stops. There's nothing more that accrues on the date of from the date of application. So should it be from that date of application? Should we provide somehow for the loss that the credit provider suffered in the sense of interest rate? What should that interest rate be if we decide that it should be something prescribed by the minister? Because the mora interest is 15%. That's very high. Should it perhaps be something prescribed by the minister if we say there should be interest, or should we say no interest? If you pay back the amount that you owed, even if it is 24 months ago, then you are rehabilitated.
Okay, this is a big question. Let's ask one of these high-paid entities that we have. National Credit Regulator, Tribunal, what do you think? Should we charge them interest if they can come back and pay off what we've written off? Mm. What should we do here? Can we please have some information from you guys? National Credit Regulator first, please.
No interest.
I need to apply my mind here, Honorable Chair. Give me a bit of time just to think through it, through this.
Thanks, Chair. Interest by its nature, Chair, is time-bound. So it means it compounds as you take longer to pay. But if you are able to pay immediately, it should cut off that interest because it's already no longer necessary. You cannot be punished by being charged interest for paying early when interest by its nature is designed to compensate the lender for the time you kept their money for. So I think it should be extinguished as you pay off the debt plus the interest that's accruing at that time up to that point.
I think that this, we must go to the committee because it's too complicated. I do understand what, okay, DTI, yes?
Chair, I don't end that much, but maybe from a policy perspective. look, I think the main idea for rehabilitation and is to reintegrate you into the mainstream of economic activities. So I think there should be, because if we are saying that we must just wipe out interest, I mean, from a business point of view, I don't think it would be a good call to make. However, to balance it, perhaps we might actually have a cap in terms of to what extent, you know, between 0 to 15%, for a person who has just been rehabilitated, for that person to come back into the economic activities, maybe we can say a 5%, a 3%, interest charged, after he or she has actually paid that debt. But that's maybe a decision for the bigger committee to take. But what I'm trying to say, I mean, we can't put a 15% if we still want this person to be actively participating in the economy, be able to access credit as well,
Thank you. We'll take that to the broader committee. If we can move to the next section.
The next question is, during the application for rehabilitation, should the credit provider be notified and should they be able to give objections? So in other words, is there any reason for, because with your normal sequestration proceedings, with rehabilitation, the credit providers can come and object and say, no, this person really needs the next 10 years to rehabilitate. They can't just come now because X, Y, and Z, it was so much money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But sequestration has a very different application as well. It's bigger amounts, et cetera, et cetera. From a lawyer's perspective, I would suggest that the credit provider is notified of the rehabilitation application. Whether to call for objections can perhaps be argued on, but because we are saying that this person is coming back into the mainstream of the economy, et cetera, I think at least that the credit provider should be notified. And then somehow they should have some input to say, but I don't think this person has rehabilitated because of X, Y, and Z. Because there is this penalty that is currently applying, or not penalty, but the restriction on rights that applies to the consumer. And it is that the consumer is trying to lift. So from a legal perspective and saying, you always need to look at both sides of the story, I would suggest that there is some way that the credit provider is involved. Whether it should be like this is perhaps debatable.
With regard to this section, surely the credit provider would be informed because they're going to get all their money back. Because the only way to be rehabilitated from debt relief is by paying the debt back again to the credit provider. So surely the credit provider would automatically be informed when this money arrived in his bank account from, I don't know, how do they go through, from the National Credit Regulator?
That is in fact exactly the point, because what if there is a credit provider that was not paid? So that is why you know, the person might come and say, oh, I've paid everyone, there it is. But then should there be someone that is not paid? Or the person might say, but I have notified my credit provider because I've paid. Here is my proof of payment. Credit provider might say, but no, I don't know even where you come from. I've never received any money. So that was the thinking. Because, yes, credit providers will know if the money is received. Yes, but what about those who did not?
Okay, I just want to talk to a scenario. Let's say I apply for debt relief, and I've got debt with, let's say, ABSA, because we're using ABSA today. I've got debt with ABSA, and it's 10,000 rand. So I've applied for this debt relief, and I'm earning less than 7, and I qualify. So surely, at this point, ABSA would be told, listen, that 10 grand that you, Adrian owes you is going to get written off according to the debt relief rules and regulations. Then I win the lotto, and now I can pay back the money. So surely they should be told again that I'm going to pay back the money because I'm going to be rehabilitated. And then it's like a closed loop instead of the credit provider being outside all the time. I think we should definitely include the credit provider in everything that, well, you know, we should keep them informed as much as possible in this bill because really, really, they are the ones paying the bill at the end of the day. And I think they should at least have information. With regard to the objection, I don't know. You tell us about this objection process in this context. Who would know? The tribunal, it's your turn, you're up.
Che, I think the key is that when the person exits this indebtedness process, there has been hearing of both sides, and the matter is decided. I would be reluctant to promote that they still have a chance to fight it out later because it might just burden the process and also burden the one we were trying to assist in the first place. Because for them to escape, it means they will have to submit the proof that they've already sorted out the exit process from that rehabilitation. So I don't think that maybe we need to require too much of the credit provider as such if there can be submission of sufficient proven evidence that they have sorted out the debt.
Because the question before us is, should they be allowed to object? Is that what we're saying here? So I'm applying to, I've paid my back the 10,000 to ABSA, but the ABSA might say, oh, this one's dodgy. He's going to, we can't, you know, rehabilitate. He can't just start borrowing money again. Is that what that says?
The idea is more to say, with sequestration, that is more where that kind of argument would come in. But, so in other words, the credit provider is maybe now notified in the sense of the 10,000 rand has been paid. If we've charged interest, everything is there, and the credit, the consumer now brings to the tribunal a document that says, here is my deposit slip, and I've paid it in. But if we notify ABSA to say, look, you know, this Williams is now here, he's going to apply for rehabilitation, he says he has paid. And ABSA says, no, he has not paid. How do they then bring that objection forward? How do they, so there must be just some provision for them to dispute the evidence that the person is bringing, to say, but no, that is not even how our deposit slips look. You know, yes, I can see it's, what I think it's red, but this is not even the kind of red that we use.
So now, could we put something into it, says, if the debt relief recipient pays back the amount, he must bring proof of that payment on a, there must be a form that the bank can give us to give to the, to bring him back, something of that nature. So he pays back, the bank must come, the bank must prove it. So it's his, the onus is on the person who received the debt relief to get the bank to acknowledge that he's paid the debt back. But we need to put that into a one sentence.
Yes, Honorable Chairperson, normally what happens with such payments by consumers is that there's what is called a paid-up letter that would come from the credit provider. and that information is then given to the consumer. And you are right. I mean, the letter must come from the credit provider.
So we don't, we won't have the objection. It's up to the consumer to get that letter from the credit provider before we can rehabilitate them back into the mainstream economy. Are we happy, Honourable Mantashe?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. National Credit Re-
What can also be done is that can also be confirmed, you know, through a credit bureau records, because the payment profile of the consumer would be reflected, you know, to show that there was a payment that was made. Because normally that information is furnished by credit providers to credit bureaus.
Okay. Next. I think that's quite simple. When we go, I mean, like I've said before, we could go back into the committee and everything that we've sort of come to some agreement on could just get changed again. But let's just keep proceeding with this.
The next question is whether prescribed debt intervention should be included in this bill or not. In other words, should the minister be given that very specific criteria, very specific process, have to consult quite significantly, and then come to Parliament for before the final one is published, or should we take this prescribed debt relief out and the minister will simply bring an act every time that he or she wants to prescribe debt relief?
You must talk into the mic, please.
Thanks, Chair. No, I was going to suggest that this be referred to the big committee. Then we will, as DTI, provide the reasoning behind.
Okay.
Thanks.
Next. Can you just also say the clauses, like you're on 88F or 88 million?
No, I'm sorry. I'm now on clause 16, section 106. So that is page 32 of the bill. I have in the meantime realized that I've made a mistake here, and I'll fix that. But this deals with credit insurance. So I had a quick discussion with the regulator outside as well. And it seems that what we require is credit life insurance. So I've drafted something. I think I need to just redraft a little bit. But the questions that we need to answer will inform the drafting. And those questions are, should credit insurance, and what the regulator indicated is credit life insurance, not just credit insurance, credit life insurance, be mandatory? And the concern here was that it will increase the price of credit. And if it is then mandatory, should it be in respect of immovable property as well, as a house? You're buying a house for $1 million, and I think the credit regulator indicated something like for every 100,000? Is it? 450
That's a current cap. But remember, these caps only came into effect in August 2016. So credit agreements that date to prior to that date could be anything because there were no caps.
Okay, before we continue, I just want to get some...
We're saying that we want to make it, or we might want to make it mandatory, that the credit is covered with insurance in the event of death or loss of income of the person. Now, if we do this, in 20 years' time, we will never have to come up with credit debt relief measures because everybody will be covered if they get retrenched or die. Is that what we're saying? Because it is to help the future. It's a good thing for the future. But I want to know what are the implications current on the present to those people who have to pay it. Is it, you know, what are the bad side about this? Can somebody tell us, the tribunal, all the credit regulator, all the department? We'll start with the department.
Thanks, Chair. I think the bad side about it, which has been in the market, is that One, you might actually be on accessing or on application for access. Accessing credit. You might be told that you require to pay a particular amount per month, per 1,000 rand, for credit life insurance. Others, they were not even told. There was no standardization in terms of the pricing, the capping, and all of that. Others would even pay 20 rand per 1,000 rand per month, 30 rand, 35 rand, 50 rand, or 100 rand, you know. So even in the event that you get retrenched, or you die, or you become, or you find yourself in a position where you can't work, you won't even be informed that you have credit life. So those are some of the things that were actually taking place. Then, since we took a decision then to bring in, yeah. So since we decided to bring in a cap to everybody, to say if you access credit, and it's even defined, credit life is defined under the NCAA as part and parcel of the cost of credit, and it must remain at 450 per 1,000 rand. So like the CEO was saying, in order to ensure that we reduce over-indebtedness, because some people, were charged 20 rand per 1,000 rand, 50 rand, even 100 rand. So, yeah, that's the rationale behind it. Yeah.
Honorable Montash?
I did not lift my hand, I'm tired.
Okay, I think that we should make it mandatory and we should put the caps in place. That's what we should do. We recommend, obviously this will go back to the big committee, but it's the recommendation because of that. We want to change people's behavior and also reduce the risk of us having to do debt relief legislation every 5 years as we spiral down into whatever we're going to.
The next question then is, should it be in respect of all debt? Should there be a cap in respect of the amount of the credit agreement? Should it be in respect of a house as well, for instance, a mortgage agreement? I am allowing that a person can get their own insurance somewhere else, so they don't have to take the bank's insurance. But still, should it be in respect of houses? Should it be for debt up to 5 billion, 6 billion? Should it just be?
What I would suggest with regard to that is we should say no. We should say it's only into in this debt relief measure, we say that it's up to, say, 50 or 100,000, the money that's potentially going to get written off in a debt relief measure. We shouldn't say that rich people have to get this insurance. I mean, they're just taking a chance. If they know that if you die without insurance, there's going to be a problem. So I think we should limit it in this case, 50,000 or 100,000, but again, take it to the big committee. Now, I just want to know how much have we got left to do, because we need to end short. I'm thinking of ending at 12 o'clock. Are you all right with that, Honourable Montash? Okay, so we're going to carry on until 12. Thank you. Continue.
We must finish, because we're on page 14 of 16 in respect of the questions. So the next one is clause 22, and it is in relation to offences. Dealing with reckless credit agreements and so on. And the only question that I have there is, when we look at a reckless credit agreement, we are making it an offense for the credit provider to enter into a reckless credit agreement. Should the converse be true as well? So if a consumer deliberately not disclose facts, should that then also be an offense?
In other words, then, when we talk about the, are we talking about in the application for debt relief, or are we talking about an application for credit? So, in other words, then, when they say, spell out your expenses, and I just forget about that other expense because I want to access credit, should that be an offence? Well, that definitely shouldn't be an offence.
Lock us up now.
we must encourage honest citizenry.
Yeah.
So I think we should.
Make it an offense.
Yes.
An offense.
Now, I disagree with that. Surely the if you don't put in the right stuff, if you don't, if you lie on your credit application, basically that's what we're talking about. What happens currently if you get caught in that lie? You don't get the credit, but what happens after the you don't get the credit if you lie on your credit application? What happens currently?
You might get the credit. If it is a deliberate lie, it would definitely be fraud because you have given false facts in order to. So, yes, that is already there. But that is a common law crime. So the question then is more, should we include it here or should we just leave it as a common law crime?
I think we should just leave it as a common law crime because in terms of common law, it's fraud, so... It's an offense.
Yes, Chair, I support that. I wanted to say that too, to say it is already an offense, it's fraud, and therefore we don't necessarily have to make the law law. It's already law.
Okay. We'll leave it then. Not me, man.
Honourable member. Okay.
The next question relates to penalties. The offence that we're creating is that any person who should be registered, so the reason I brought this section in is because it deals with unlawful agreements, and it specifically deals with an agreement that is unlawful or a practice that is unlawful because the person is giving themselves out to be a credit provider or a credit provider of the developmental credit when they're not, a credit bureau, the credit bureau, debt counselor, payment distribution agent, alternative dispute resolution agent were then pulled in because the same principles apply. But the main reason for including this is, so if a credit provider or a debt counselor tells a person that I am a credit provider and therefore I can do X, Y, and Z, then it's an unlawful agreement. The debt review will be unlawful, and that is now made an offense. The question then is, should we attach a specific penalty to that, or what the Act provides for in general, any offence, is 12 months or an equivalent fine? Or should this non-registration attract perhaps the 10% annual turnover type of penalty?
I'd like the tribunal and the regulator to talk on this matter, please. We'll start with the tribunal.
Can you just repeat the question? Sorry.
Where any of the credit provider, the credit bureau, debt counselor, payment distribution agent, alternative dispute resolution agent were not registered, but they said, no, I am a payment distribution agent, or I am a credit provider, or I am a credit bureau, that is now made an offense. So the question is, should that attract a special penalty or the general penalty, which is 12 months or an equivalent fine? Because there are other offences, like entering into a reckless agreement, that we are now saying attracts a fine or imprisonment, not to a fine if the person is not a natural person, a fine exceeding 10% of annual turnover, and if it's a natural person, 10 years or a fine and imprisonment. So should it be a higher penalty or the normal 12 months penalty if you say you are registered and you're not?
Yeah, Chair, I would say this would be fine so long as it is enforceable. The enforcing part may be the difficult one, in that these people will not necessarily be traceable. But where they can be identified and traced, maybe there is a paper trail which can amount to proof that this is the offender, then I would say it should be sufficient, the way I see it. As a starting point, the enforceability part will be the deterrent, because if we just have it there but they are still running amok pretending to be who they are not, then they will just continue. Except just like the guys who are doing abortions and they are not doctors and they are all over town, they know it's illegal, but so long as there is no police catching them, they just carry on. So I think the enforceable part is more critical than adjusting the sentence or the punishment.
Which I do agree. Yeah.
Do DTI want to say anything here? Are you sure?
I don't know what to do here.
No, I think we should take it to the board committee. Yeah, when in doubt, take it to the committee.
The next question is also about penalties. The first question is, if a person who has provided false information on the debt intervention, is the penalty of, I didn't say capital A, the fine or imprisonment not exceeding 10 years, is that too harsh, or is that the type of penalty that we want to place on applicants who provide false information on the debt intervention application?
Yeah. I think that's a big committee question because of its implications. You know, you could be applying for 5,000 rand debt relief and get 10 years in prison because you lied on your application form. I think it's a bit hectic. But I think we should take it to the big committee, that section.
Last question, same question, but just in respect of fines, if you have done reckless lending, unlawful lending, those kind of things, is it then too harsh to say if you're a natural person, you can be sentenced to 10 years or imprisonment, a fine or both fine and imprisonment, or if you're a company, a fine not exceeding 10% of annual turnover? So that is the question, because that is where we were looking at the turnover and things like that on the reckless lending. Is that then what we want? And I think if I look at Mr. McPherson's input, it is also the same, 10% of turnover. I think he just added not exceeding 1 million. So that is perhaps something that can be added.
With regard to this, I also think it should go to the big committee, but while we're sitting here, I do think we have some consensus. I think that we can go with this as it is and take that to the big committee because the opposition have come in with the same numbers. So basically there's consensus on that. I'm just a bit skeptical of this not exceeding 1 million rands because if the credit provider is a huge company like, for instance, ABSA, I suppose 1 million rand, you know, it's nothing for them. But, I mean, it depends how many times they do it. You know, if they do it 100 times, that's quite a lot of money. But it is, I think we should include the not exceeding a million rands story. DTR?
I think I agree with you. I mean, also the one of the determining factor would be the amount of the reckless loan book. It will actually give you an indication of how much you can or how far you can go in terms of the fine. If we're going to say or limit it to not more than 1 million, I mean, it could be just be a loan book of 2 billion, yet you have to charge somebody. No, I'm saying it could be just be a loan book of 2 billion of reckless lending, and yet you are saying that particular credit provider should actually be charged 1 million. I mean, it's quite ridiculous. It's better if we broaden it up and show, but it can be taken to the bigger committee. But my proposal is that less than 1 million would really be a drop in the ocean on a 2 billion reckless loan book. Thanks.
So I think that we should... See, it's very difficult, this, because of the fact... My concern, I'll tell you, around these penalties and things is we're writing legislation dealing with debt relief for the poorest of the poor, and at the same time we're putting in penalties for reckless lending that could affect the richest of the rich. And so our understanding of, you know, if somebody fined me 1 million rand, it would be the end of me. But, I mean, if somebody fined ABSA 1 million rand, they might just, you know, they might pay the debt on purpose, like some companies do, in fact, break the law and then pay the debt. Pay the fine. So I think we should take it to the broader committee. This has to be discussed more about the implications of this, because if you're a single if you're a small, you know, you're lending money in a small capacity and they fine you R1 million, then that's going to be very detrimental to you. But like we said, ABSA, for instance, will just shrug off R1 million and carry on. If we're using ABSA as an example, yeah, not particular ABSA. So there we go. So we'll take it to the big committee. Are we done? All right, we're done. So what we're going to do is we're going to get this repackaged, as it were, and then in the big committee, which is next week. Sorry? When? Tuesday? For this meet? For this date?
Yeah.
Okay. So next week, 9 o'clock on Tuesday, we're going to, the big committee will be talking about debt relief, and then we can start really getting it down, because we have to have our final document by the 14th. So we must all be ready to, you know, release it to the world around, well, it'll be the end of the month, but it's going to take some days to get it ready, but by the 14th. So I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Honorable Mantash, thank you very much for coming. And we'll see you next week. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.